The views and opinions expressed by A Little Bit Culty are those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the podcast. Any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business, individual, anyone, or anything. Welcome to A Little Bit Culty, a podcast about what happens when something that seems like a great thing at first goes to the dark side and takes you with it. I'm your host, Sarah Edmondson.
And I'm also your host, Anthony Ames, aka Nippy. Sarah and I met, fell in love in a quote, self-help organization that turned out to be a mega cult called Nexium. Heard of it? We got out of there together, and on our way out, we helped shut it down. Our journey as Nexium whistleblowers was captured in detail on a docuseries called The Vow on HBO, and also on the front page of a newspaper.
New York Times, babe.
Right.
Have you heard of it? Each week on A Little Bit Culty, we talk with other former cult members and whistleblowers, plus experts in things like cultic abuse and coercive control.
We also turn the mic over to advocates and clinicians with wisdom to share on recovering from everything from MLMs and toxic religion to bad romances with raging narcissists.
There's always something to learn about the cultiverse. Be sure to subscribe to A Little Bit Culty so you don't miss an episode. Find us on Instagram and at alittlebitculty.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back.
Season four.
We didn't really take much of a break there, did we now?
Nope.
Partly that's because we didn't want to wait. We have so much incredible content for you coming up in season four. Today, we have a brave survivor from the Osho community who's coming forward after almost 45 years of silence. In upcoming episodes, we'll be doing deep dives talking about Greek life on college campuses, Orthodox Judaism, Jehovah's Witnesses, corporate culture, and even a secret society in upper crust New York circles that might be a super freaky sex cult.
Corporate culture. That's the one that gets me now.
So much culty shit to cover. And truthfully, I find them all interesting. But this one in particular, I gotta say, serious trigger warning. We're gonna be talking about some really dark stuff, including sexual abuse of children. So please do not listen to this with your kids around. Our guest today has a heartbreaking and important story.
So the support we've received in the first three seasons from, you know, Austin to online has been so amazing. Sarah and I, we talk about it continuously. And it's restored our faith. And we love the opportunity to pay it forward for others. We think being able to share the truth in the way that we have is one of the things that will bring people together. And truth, I think, saves the world. And doing it sometimes comes with slings and arrows. And this story here, to me, is one of the more brave ones that we've had because it's someone who's come to terms with what's happened to them late in life. There's really no reason to do it except for the fact that I think truth was knocking on her conscience. And to be able to create a platform for her to do that, considering how tough this is and triggering it is, it will be. I think it's important because a lot of people get into these groups in the pursuit of truth because the person attracting them claims to have it. And at some point, the collective leadership loses sight of that or they never had it with their real goal in mind anyway. So always reconciling the delusion, you have to eat some humble pie. And you know, we've done that and created this platform, and Aaron has trusted us with her story, so we take that very seriously. So thank you, everyone who's made this possible and the support that we've had going forward. Hopefully, we can make it bigger and bring more truth.
Well said. And I feel really honored that our guest today, whose name is Aaron Robbins, trusts us to use A Little Bit Culty to expose the truth about her former master. Aaron Robbins wasn't actually in Wild Wild Country, the 2018 Netflix docuseries about the controversial Indian guru Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, also known as Osho. She lived the wild, wild country in real time. And she wasn't just one of the many Osho devotees, also known as sannyasins. She was part of his innermost circle.
She discovered his teachings as a 20-something in 1978. And by the time he summoned her to his bedroom barely a year later for a, quote, special and secret meeting, she thought he was the greatest spiritual master who'd ever walked the planet.
When that secret meeting with Osho turned into what Aaron describes as a vile and violating encounter, the first of many, she tried to let go, just as his teachings encouraged. She also remained quiet after her name made it onto Osho's kill list of people who were to be taken out if they ever breathed a word about his many misdeeds.
Growing up both privileged and sheltered as the daughter of the co-founder and owner of Baskin-Robbins Ice Cream Company, Erin knew that her father was opposed to her becoming one of the guru's disciples and that defying her father came with the real risk of losing a significant inheritance. But she was so enthralled by Rajneesh's promise of a world where love and joy prevailed that she was willing to give up her family and financial future to follow him.
Erin gave over her life to a man who said he was God and promised heaven on earth. Without a clue, he would turn out to lead his disciples into a world of murders, mass poisonings, including the single largest bioterrorist attack in United States history, and the gross sexual violation of hundreds of children.
Erin never spoke a word of what she'd experienced and witnessed while in Osho's orbit, not even when Netflix came knocking.
She never spoke a word about it until now, that is. We have so much to ask her. Here's our chat with Erin Robbins. Hello, Erin. Welcome.
Hi, Erin.
Hello, Sarah and Nippy.
How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling pretty good. Really happy to be here and really happy that you invited me to speak.
Well, it's a big moment, I think, for you and the world, the community of people who have fallen in love, out of love with the teachings of, do you refer to him as Osho or Bhagwan? There's so many names.
There's so many names. You can use either. It's fine.
Okay.
I probably will refer to him more as Bhagwan because that's how I spoke of him, but Osho, Bhagwan, him, whatever.
So when people listen to this podcast, they will have already heard an introduction to you and a little bit about the sannyasins and the community and Osho and Wild Wild Country and all those things. But assuming that people haven't watched that documentary or they don't know much about the group or Bhagwan, would you mind giving us a little backstory? And you can start with your introduction if you'd like who you were when you met him. We really love to share with our audience, what was the hook? How did you get in? What did you think you were getting into? Will you take us back to the 70s when you first met him and how you were introduced to Bhagwan?
Yes, I was living in Massachusetts at the time. I was going to graduate school. I had always been very interested in spiritual things. As a child, I was just fascinated by what was this mystery that was bringing life to happen? You know, what was beating our hearts? What the heck was going on here? And I was always really searching to find answers. And when I was in graduate school and a friend said, oh, I have a friend who just came back from India from this incredible place. You've got to meet her. I was quite interested too, because I had also been very interested in the East, in Eastern mysticism and spirituality. And so I went to visit this friend at a farm in Maine, and she had just come back from India. And she was wearing orange clothes, and she had a necklace of wooden beads around her neck with a big picture of her guru. And I found it all just sort of interesting, a little interesting. But, you know, I was curious, I would say. So she said she wanted to show us his meditations. And Rajneesh had been known for his techniques, both meditations and different therapies, where he was really blending Western psychology and Eastern mysticism in a pretty dynamic way that was attracting a lot of people, like thousands of people were going there from around the world. I was interested. So we did this meditation, and the meditation consisted of, and there's three of us there, just some friends, and we're in her farmhouse in Maine, and we start doing the first part of the meditation, which was really quite evocative music with a strong drum beat and very heavy hyperventilating, breathing in and out, nostril breathing, really strong, and using the whole body to get as worked up and as strong as you could. So we did that for, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes. And then the next stage was a total catharsis, yell, scream, jump, cry, go crazy, beat the air, beat the ground. And then after 15 minutes of that, I could have this wrong because it's been many years, obviously, but it was jumping on our heels with our hands up in the air, straight up yelling, who, mm-hmm. That for a period of time. And then there was a period of silence. So when I was done with the meditation, or we were done, I felt pretty elated. I mean, it was very invigorating. and I felt a little bit, I don't know, kind of in a really good mellow space, a little bit of exhaustion, I would say, from the intense activity. But then she played us a tape of Rajneesh speaking, and his voice was absolutely hypnotic. I thought at the time, beautifully hypnotic. It was very easy to listen to. I didn't understand all his words because his Hindi accent was thick, but he spoke in a kind of way that just sort of lulled me in. I couldn't understand it all, but what I caught from what he was speaking was beautiful, like speaking about the mystery of life and the beauty of life and being one with all life. And I was quite taken, actually, at that point. I thought, wow, I've never met anybody like this. I've never known anybody who seems to come from this space before. I spent the weekend there. She told lots of stories about the ashram. And by the time I left, she handed me an orange silk shirt, a mala with his picture on it. And she said he had told her that she would meet two or three people, and he had given malas for those people, and that she would be meeting his people, and she would recognize them. So since I was very interested, she recognized me as one of his people. So I went home with the orange clothes and a photograph of him and the mala. And 6 weeks later, I was getting off of an Air India flight in Mumbai. I had signed up for a program, a training program for therapists to learn his techniques and his meditations and his approach, and to learn a radically new way of doing psychotherapy, which really included a lot of Eastern philosophy, Eastern approaches, and his techniques. So I signed up for, I don't know if it was 6 weeks or 3 months, I don't know, but I signed up for a program for therapists. When I got to the ashram, first of all, when I got to India, India in the 70s was quite primitive still. Sanitation was very poor, and it was like being catapulted into another universe. Hmm. You know, walking down the streets in the town where the ashram was, I mean, there were as many water buffalo and snake charmers with little men on the streets with cobras dancing, and women in bright magenta saris with big, huge things on their head. It was so exotic to me. And when I walked in the gate of the ashram, the world outside, which was busy and intense, just softened. There was this flute music playing in the background in the distance from a hall somewhere on the property. Beautiful flute music with tambura and other percussion instruments, Eastern instruments. And I remember walking in the gate and immediately being transfixed, immediately being just like, where am I? Everybody was wearing orange. Everyone seemed to be laughing or hugging, or little groups of people playing music and dancing in little clusters, lots of hugging, mostly young people, and they were from all over the world. And I really loved that international quality. I was really jazzed to be out of my Los Angeles, where I had grown up, culture, and in a bigger culture. Interesting enough, after I had been there a day, I kind of freaked out and I thought, ooh, this is group mind. Everybody's wearing the same clothes. What's with the necklace? This is too weird. I don't want to get involved in any group mind was how I saw it. Mm-hmm. I took off the orange clothes that I had brought and I put back on my street clothes, my blue jeans or whatever, and decided that I was just going to kind of check it out a little bit more. Do a few more meditations and check it out. So I did do a few more meditations and I listened to his speaking, and I think it lasted about a day that I kept my regular clothes on, and I was back in orange a day later.
You heard him speaking in person, or you're still hearing tapes at this point?
At this point, when I got there, he was speaking once a day to the public, and usually for a couple of hours in the morning. And then in the evening, he spoke to a small group of people who had been invited for what he called darshan. And there was maybe 30 people or so who were there. And the group in the morning was several hundred people who were listening to his discourses. He spoke in English 1 month and then in Hindi 1 month. And he spoke on many sutras from different traditions. He used them as his jumping point, and he expounded on these different sutras from different traditions. Mm-hmm. I was enthralled by the scene around him. I was enthralled by what he said. I was enthralled by how I felt when I sat in the hall. I mean, if I could paint the picture for you, it was like a jungle garden outside, and then it was a patio outside of his house. When the several hundred people gathered to listen to him, it was totally silent. Like nobody said a word until he came in. So he's sitting and all we could hear was the birds and the insects from the garden around. And then suddenly he came in his plain white robe. And he really, to me, he looked like the absolute picture of a holy man from the East. But then once he started speaking, I'd never seen anybody like him. His eyes were like deep, deep wells that you just fall into. And he didn't blink very much. So he gazed very intensely. And it seemed to me like I had never seen anybody that was as conscious and present and loving as him. That was my first impression.
Before you go over there, did you feel like your life was on a trajectory? And then like when you're in grad school and you're doing the things kind of that you're trained to do and that we're told to do in traditional schooling, you're on a trajectory. Sometimes it's not that clear. And then something like this presents itself. Did you feel like you were on one trajectory? And then when you get in this atmosphere and you start to have this experience, it starts to put you on another one that's more purposeful? Or was it your curiosity that got you there because the trajectory that you were on wasn't as fulfilling? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. Just a little backstory about this. So when I was at school in California, in Santa Cruz, I was majoring in theater and in art. And when I was painting, and I found this with any creative experience, painting, dancing, theater, I was having very profound experiences. I began to get really interested in the creative process and the expressive arts. So I went to school in expressive arts therapies because I felt I could help people have this experience that I was having when I was immersed in the arts. So I was on a trajectory. I was definitely on a clear career path, and I had not been entirely satisfied with the program I was in because it was a little bit more medical model oriented, mm-hmm. like they were using the expressive arts therapies diagnostically. And I was really interested in the actual process. So I was looking to expand my understanding of what brings people into a state of peace and happiness and balance in life.
So this seemed more aligned with that than what you were doing?
Yes, it did.
Okay.
It seemed aligned and it also seemed connected because when I got to the ashram, everybody was singing and dancing and celebrating. That was my deal. I loved to dance. I loved to sing and I wanted to help people in the arts.
Definitely would have been your jam, Sarah.
Yeah. I mean, I've told you this before and I'll probably say it many times is that even when I saw Wild Wild Country, I said to Nippy, you know, if I'd been 18, because I was born in 77. Right. So I was a little young for it. But if I was a little bit older and I'd heard about this, I would have been all over it. I mean, just from what I have seen in the videos and especially with Wild Wild Country and also the colors. Like I had a girlfriend in grade two who I think her family had relocated from Oregon to Vancouver. And they were all in the colors. And, you know, in the 80s and when I was 7 years old, pink and red that was totally my jam. And then my mom explained to me it was a religion and that's what the colors they wore. And I thought that was great. Like I wanted to be a part of that at age 7 because of Tui.
It's amazing.
Yeah, a little girl named Tui. I wish I remembered her last name. You may have known her parents. I don't know. Back to you. So you're at this ashram. You're not sure. It's a little bit weird, but the meditations are helping you and you're enthralled by Osho, the hugging and the dancing. Like, so it's all there. It sounds very utopic, I'm imagining. Yes.
It was pretty extraordinary. I have to say, still in all my years and experiences, I've never been in a group of people like that. I mean, we were really high. We were high off of what he was saying. We were high off of the meditations. We were high off of being with each other, the kind of collective energy. It was, I don't know, it was pulsing. It was so alive and it was magnificent.
That was the good. There has to be good, right? Otherwise.
There was good. There was. And the people, fantastic people, incredible people. And music. You know, I had never heard music like that. That music just took me to heaven. It just, it just took my soul and put me into bliss, you know? And the music was a big part of it there.
Sounds a little bit like, I don't know if you've heard much about the ecstatic dance movement that's happening right now.
Yes.
Yeah. And I haven't done it myself, but I've heard that it brings people to that state. I mean, I don't know if it's culty or problematic. Maybe we'll do that another episode, but just in terms of what the movement does for your body. And I've certainly been to, you know, raves before in the 90s. There was other substances that help, but there's certainly levels of ecstasy and group vibration, whatever you want to call that, that can bring people to a different level of consciousness, I believe.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It was definitely an exalted state that we were in most of the time.
Were there drugs too or no?
Not in my experience when I was there. I didn't. Okay. I had heard people were dealing drugs to make money to be in the ashram. And when I think back on it, that should have been a red flag that there was so much illegal activity that was going on to make it possible for people to be there.
Did you move there right away? And what was the trajectory from the ashram to Oregon for you? Can you tell us a little bit about your journey?
Yes. So I went there for this training program for 6 or 12 weeks, whatever it was. At that point, by then, I did have a darshan with Osho, and he gave me my name. My name was Ma Prem Maitri.
What does that mean?
Prem means love, and Maitri is friendship, friendliness. He explained to me when he gave me the name that romantic or attached love was really a lower form of love, that the highest form of love was not attached, was not possessive, was a friendliness. So I'd had my direct meeting with him, and he told me to go back and finish my master's thesis and then come back. He said, I will need you. We are going to create a new humanity. This is a, sometimes called it an experiment to create a possibility for a future of humanity that can live in a expanded high consciousness, in love, in celebration, in peace. I will need you. So I finished my thesis, I got my degree, and I was on the plane the next week back. And he very, very quickly pulled me into the center of things. He asked me to start writing introductions to his books, and he asked me to start leading groups, therapy groups, and be part of his group of, he had chosen, at that point, it was still a small group of people who were leading workshops for people who came. And he actually told people which workshops to do and who they should do it with. And he placed the people in the groups. So I stayed at the ashram then for the entire remainder of the time until he left India. And I lived very closely because he brought me really close in, invited me to extra darshans, gave me gifts, elevated me to, you know, be part of the elite group of people who he had leading workshops. And I was young. I was much younger than most of them, actually. But I stayed there, and through all of that time, which was pretty intense, he had a group of, I don't know if it was about 9 women that he had selected to be his energy mediums in his darshans, where he worked with people by giving a form of Shaktipat or energy. And he used these women, I was one of them, as vehicles to transmit his energy.
Can you explain what that looks like?
You know, there's two what it looked like. I can tell you what it looked like for me then, and then it's what it looked like to me now.
Trust me, I understand that.
Well, yeah, you do. So what it looked to me like then is, oh my God, I am being chosen to be close to him. And what he was teaching was that if you wanted to become enlightened, if you wanted to really have the highest possibility of human consciousness, the way to do that, the way to get there was through surrendering to him as the master he was. And he explained to us that very rarely on the planet were born beings of exceedingly high consciousness who, when they walked the earth, those who were fortunate enough to gather around them had an opportunity that may only come every 1,000 lifetimes. It was so rare. And he said, those of us who had gathered around him there in India, he said we were the same group that had gathered around the Buddha 2,500 years ago, and that this was our moment to come back, and that Buddha was coming back as him, basically. And he really emphasized what an extraordinary opportunity this was. And the way to do it, because he was such a great master, was to totally surrender, which meant to say yes to everything that happened around him. Because he explained to us that around a master of that caliber, everything that happens in his vicinity, everything that happens is for their awakening, that his only reason for being alive was to awaken us.
We tell our stories. We change the world. A Little Bit Culty is proud to support the hashtag I Got Out project, which empowers survivors of cultic abuse to share their stories online as a catalyst for education, prevention, and healing. Learn more about the hashtag I Got Out movement and find resources at igotout.org.
After years of getting ripped off by big wireless providers, there's finally a better option. Mint Mobile is the affordable premium wireless service that you buy online, starting at just $15 a month. By cutting out retail stores, Mint Mobile got rid of the crazy overhead costs so that you could score some sweet savings every month. To get your new wireless phone plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/save. That's mintmobile.com/save.
Did anyone learn a language in high school and then let it go and then have regrets about that later? If you're anything like me, then maybe you'll relate. I did French all the way up into 12th grade, and then I let it go. I mean, I lived in Montreal for a few years and, you know, practiced a bit, but it just slipped away. And then I found Babbel. Babbel is the language learning app that sold more than 10 million subscriptions. And thanks to Babbel's addictively fun and easy little bite-sized language lessons, I've been able to get back my French. I've actually found learning French to be fun again. And c'est vrai, je parle français. With Babbel, you only need 10 minutes to complete a lesson, so you can start having real-life conversations in a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Other language learning apps use AI for their lesson plans, but Babbel lessons were created by over 150 language experts and voiced by real native speakers, not computers. Their teaching method has been scientifically proven to be effective. And with Babbel, you can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. Formidable. That means wonderful in French. Plus, Babbel's speech recognition technology helps you to improve your pronunciation and accent. Clearly still working on that. There are so many ways to learn with Babbel. In addition to lessons, you can access podcasts, games, videos, stories, and even live classes. Plus, it comes with a 20-day money-back guarantee. Start your new language learning journey today with Babbel. Right now, when you purchase a 3-month Babbel subscription, you'll get an additional 3 months for free. That's 6 months for the price of 3. Just go to babbel.com and use promo code CULTY. That's BABBEL.com, code CULTY. Our team at A Little Bit Culty Podcasts loves the Blood Ties podcast because it is gritty and current and fascinating. It's also a little bit culty. Blood Ties, the award-winning audio drama from Wondery, returns for its third season, Strange Days, with another thrilling story about greed, power, and deception. 5 years have passed since Eleanor, played by Julian Jacobs of Community, took over as CEO of the infamous Richland family empire, alongside her half-brother, Santino, played by Christian Navarro of 13 Reasons Why. Together, they decide to invest the family fortune in a groundbreaking, controversial new drug. But as shocking revelations about the new treatment emerge, Eleanor and Santino go to every length to protect their control of the Richland family dynasty. As Eleanor's father always said, medicine is a bloody business. Listen to Blood Ties, Season 3, Strange Days, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or you can binge the whole series now, early and ad-free, by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
How long in were you before that was sprung on you? And was that overt?
Oh.
Did other people know about that? Or was that something that was...
It was overt. And okay. I was probably back there a couple months when he started calling me for darshans, extra darshans. And then he formed this group maybe, I don't know, some months later. Not very long at all. It was very overt. What was so special, everybody wanted to go to darshan as often as they could. And we got to go every night.
I see. So it was billed as something to covet.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Big time.
Well, let me ask you, how did it make you feel to be chosen?
Oh, my God. I mean, Sarah, I felt like, I mean, I died and gone to heaven. I mean, it was like I couldn't have wanted more. I wanted, when I was near him, like in the darshans or in the discourses, what happened in my body, I felt ecstatic. I was in bliss. So I just wanted it. That's all I wanted was to be. What I said then was at his feet, in his presence. And I'm not speaking alone. I know that this was the case for
probably many women.
Many, if mm-hmm. not all, if not all. So mm-hmm. I felt really seen. I felt valued. I felt respected. And I felt acknowledged because mm-hmm. I thought I must have some really ancient connection with him from past lives that he's choosing me for this.
Right.
I mean, there's thousands of people here and there's only like 8 or 9 women doing this. This is like a big deal. So I felt very, very privileged and very honored. And I felt like I understood it because I really did feel like I had that kind of deep connection with him. But if I look at it now, mm-hmm. you know, and I look back at it, I say, excuse my French, but I say, what the fuck? I'm invited to go to this special meeting with the master. And the instructions I was given is to wear a loose robe and not to wear any underwear.
Oh, my God.
Uh-huh. So
wow.
That's how it started.
Wow. So that's probably, you didn't see it at the time, but the first red flag?
Oh, I don't think it was the first.
Okay.
It was
first big red flag.
It was a big one.
Well, it sounds like your instincts to not wear that stuff and go all in with the traditions, you had the natural resistance to the groupthink initially, which is normal, which everyone has, I mean, I think.
And I don't know if we mentioned the outfit. So everyone was in orange, red, and pink, and purple. Is that right? Were those the colors?
At that
colors?
Point, it was just orange.
It
graduated to expand into purples and reds and pinks. At that point, it was just really orange.
Okay.
It was weird.
But so you did have the red flag, right? Then?
Oh, yeah.
And that actually meant to ask you, so when you, just to backtrack for a second, when you walked into the ashram and you're like, I'm going to put my jeans back on, then you decided to go for it again. Your instincts were saying this is weird, but you decided to give it a go. Why? Was it because you like paid the money to get there and like you wanted your money, you don't want to like waste it, or like mm-hmm. you just thought, hey, maybe I'm wrong. Like what was your thought process that said, hey, I'm just going to keep going?
I thought these people definitely, this is my tribe. I just
okay.
felt it. A little bit on the radical side, a little bit unconventional, very creative. Beautiful people, mm-hmm. accomplished people from all over the world. I'm here. I may as well get what I can out of it. My gosh.
Right.
And also I thought he has something. There was something mm-hmm. so enticing about him.
Right. So all those good things outweighed that little feeling in your stomach that it was weird. And you continue and he invites you and makes you feel all the things you said and special. What happened after that? I know from Wild Wild Country, all of a sudden they decided to pick up and move to Oregon. Were
right.
you part of that exodus?
Well, what happened, and I should just say, just to fill in the story a little bit, that period of these special darshans where he had this group of women, that went on for a couple years every day. And the group of women expanded and he tried new women were invited and then they were dropped. But I was constant through the whole time. Mm-hmm. And I was leading groups, so I worked with thousands of people who came. I was leading workshops with them. When he went to America, when he left the ashram one day, it was shrouded in mystery. Nobody knew why. Nobody knew where he was going. Somebody said it was medical. Everybody kind of knew it wasn't. Sheila had been talking about wanting to have the commune in the States, and he had wanted to find land in India. We had way outgrown the ashram because there were thousands of people and it was only 6 acres. We had to rent many, many homes in the neighborhood and definitely needing a bigger place. So it was very secretive what happened. I actually was told by somebody in the office or whatever that what actually had happened, because at that point I was living in his house, his actual residence. I knew, and I was on such the inn that I kind of heard what it was. And I saw who was gone because some of the people from the house were gone. We all left India and then they had bought the ranch in Oregon and it took about a year. In this interim year, all of the people who were the therapists and leading the workshops, we were sent to a center in Southern California in Lucerne Valley. And so people continued to do the programs. We continued to teach because we were sort of making the daily bread. We were making the money. So we all went there. And then after about a year, once they had built some of the roads and enough trailers had been brought to the ranch for us to live in, we went up to the ranch to live.
So you were one of the first.
I was still in the ashram, even though I was in limbo in California and here and
right.
there. We were still all as a group being told what to do and where to go. And I want to just explain a little bit about his teaching of surrendering to him. Mm-hmm. He stressed it deeply and continuously that surrender had to be 100%. Like he kept saying, using metaphors like water boils at 212 degrees. 210 degrees won't do it. It doesn't work. So surrendering to a master like this has to be 100%.
Right.
Total. He talked about saying yes to everything that happened around him.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the door through which we would become merged with him and finally disappear as a separate person and become one with him and this enlightened consciousness. But it could only happen in complete surrender and accepting everything. So, you know, what was happening that throughout this whole period in India was that I was getting messages from his caretaker to come in the night, in the middle of the night. You know, at first I didn't know why, but he would have me take off my clothes and touch me. And there was a lot of sexual, I don't know how to say this part.
However you feel comfortable saying it, and you can say things or not say it.
Right.
I think what's important here is that up until now, and I think this is important to note, is something with like Wild Wild Country, it left certain things ambiguous or didn't include what you're about to share, which is that he
abused you.
He abused you. He sexually abused you. Did he ask you if you were?
No.
Right.
Never.
Well, the pretenses of surrender is the initial abuse.
Yeah. I mean, and I've thought about it so many times since then. If I had gone into a room with a man twice my age, who the minute I walked in the room, he told me to take my clothes off, I would have been, if I had had my senses about me, I would have been out the door faster than you could say hello. I mean.
Right. But you were groomed.
I didn't.
No.
I took my clothes off. Mm-hmm. I did what he said. Mm-hmm. He said, come close to me. I went close to him. I did what he asked of me. And those meetings, including the sexual abuse, went on throughout those years in India. And I continued to hold it because he had told me never to tell anyone. I held it in myself that it was this very profound, incredible connection I had with him that was, I didn't talk to anybody about it. In fact, I didn't really talk to anybody about it for over 40 years.
I would like to circle back later to how you decided to tell people about it.
Yeah, yeah.
So the only other person that knew was his caretaker because she brought you to him.
At that time in India, yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you two ever talk about it?
No. You know, we all didn't talk to each other much.
Mm-hmm.
We only talked about the work we were doing and past the doll at dinner or whatever. First of all, we were working all the time, like, I don't know, 14 some hours a day, maybe more. Plus there were the darshans and the discourses and everything. And so there wasn't time. And when we did have time, we were so tired that we just fell asleep.
Mm-hmm.
The relationships that I thought were, they are close in a feeling way, but they were never developed. We didn't really have time to talk with each other much. He was very specific with this group of women who were the mediums that we were specifically told never to discuss our experiences in darshan with each other either.
By him.
Yes.
You were siloed strategically.
Yes.
That's so hard.
So then to get back to your question about going to Oregon, just to kind of get the trajectory of how things went down. So we all went to Oregon, and the day I got there that night, sure enough, I got a message. This time it was from Sheila, who had taken over as secretary, and to come see him. And that started up again. And it wasn't as often in the years at the ranch in Oregon, but it was continuous.
For those who don't know or who haven't watched Wild Wild Country, can you tell our audience who Sheila is?
Sheila was his secretary from, oh gosh, I think it must have been about 1980, give or take.
Yeah, it was roughly that, because she was married 13 years. And then I think when he died, I think it's when she went into the official secretary role. Wasn't that right, Sarah?
Yeah, from the documentary. What was your relationship like with her, with Sheila?
Ooh. Sheila did not like anyone who had personal access to Osho.
I bet.
At all. She was very jealous, and it was very obvious to everybody. So she hated me. While I was in India, he had me write a book about the experience of being a disciple. And she one day, toward the end, just before they flew off to the US, she asked me for all my copies of it. And silly me, I didn't think about it, but I gave it to her. We didn't have computers back then. We had carbon paper and typewriters. So I gave her my copies of it. And she later told me that she burned it.
Ugh. Oh,
2 years of work. She would do anything. She did not like me at all.
No, the arrogance that she exudes in the documentary, while it may be like cute and get the Osho movement going and stuff like that, anyone who's that arrogant is doomed to destroy whatever they touch.
Yeah, her arrogance was so hard to take.
Oh my God. Oh my God. And the lack of self-awareness where she is cast herself as this righteous person and so overtly arrogant.
So, you know, obviously you were there for a long time. And can you tell us some of the things before you left and some of the things that you saw there that you didn't understand were problematic, like the red flags that you missed because of your belief in who he was, maybe perhaps clouding that judgment because you didn't have the full picture yet?
You know, I found that we always had to capitalize H when we wrote he. It was always in capital. He, capital H, he. That used to get in my stomach at the beginning, but then I got used to it. But I would say that should have been a red flag. He had a perspective, what I understood from him, and many of us did, was about children that should have been a red flag, because he was professing to be interested in the future of humanity, but yet he said that children were a distraction to our awakening and to our relationship with him. Having children was discouraged. People who were pregnant were suggested to have abortions. People who had children were suggested to keep their children with their ex-spouses in their other country, that they basically leave their children to be with him. And many people were suggested, it was encouraged and strongly encouraged to get sterilized. So many young women and men were sterilized. And I've thought about this with you, Sarah, with your branding that you had. And when I first saw and heard your story, I thought, oh my God, I have a scar too under my navel from where I was sterilized at age 25.
Wow.
Oh my God, Aaron. I didn't know that. So sorry.
Wow.
Children were definitely seen as a distraction, and I did not put it together that how does this work? If you're interested in the future of humanity, and then you give no supervision, no value to the kids. You consider them a distraction. The kids who were there, they did not get good care. They were basically ignored. There was a little bit of a school something going on, but the kids really had it rough. And what I didn't know at the time, but I have come to learn now, is that those kids that were brought by their parents, for the most part, were not allowed to live in the ashram. They lived in huts around. But those who did live there and that were part of the scene there, while all the adults were busy, we were busy singing exalted love songs to God, you know, singing hallelujah in groups of thousands of us over and over. And meanwhile, while we were busy doing that, the kids were being raped continuously.
Holy
continuously,
shit.
Heinously. I heard a report recently from one girl who she said, before she was 13, she made a list. She had slept with over 100 adult men from the ashram. Before she was 13.
Oh, my God.
How is this kept secret? I mean, Wild Wild Country, the doc doesn't go into any of that.
That's my question, too. I have no idea. Well, no, I shouldn't say I have no idea, because they hadn't spoken much about it yet. It's just new. It's just like in the last very short period of time that those kids who were brought to, who were either born there or they came with their parents there, they just started to speak out about their experiences. They are naming people and they are, but they are not contributing it to Bhagwan or to Osho. They're really just seeing their experiences, which I understand because they were never interested in Osho.
No, they weren't there for Osho. Their parents brought them.
Right.
Was Sheila and the lawyer, I believe his name is Peter, is that his name?
Yes.
Would they have known about this?
Yes.
Wow.
So they're on that documentary.
I mean, it doesn't surprise me that Sheila would.
Well, I don't know how they wouldn't.
Well, yeah, I mean, Sheila seems to be, but like the lawyer seemed, I mean, I don't, you know, he seemed legitimately, I mean, I think it's possible to go through that experience and not know about it, especially if you don't have kids, but.
Well, he has, but I can't really say what he knew or what he didn't know. That's mm-hmm. pretty hard for me to know. But what I knew was I saw grown men with young kids. I actually thought maybe they were being like father figures because we were supposed to all be aunties and uncles to the kids because Osho had said, you know, it's better for the kids not to live with their parents. It's better if they don't see them very often. Then when they see them, it will be good. They shouldn't see them regularly. So I just thought that these older guys were being uncles to the young girls. I didn't know until later.
Infuriating. You know, and also it answers something for me, Erin. I don't know if I told you this, but I'm not going to say her name, but there's a woman who's still loyal to Keith who I found out after we left, because I was so surprised when people stayed when everything came out. And it turns out she was raised a sannyasin. I'm guessing she's my age. She's probably like early 40s and mid 40s maybe. And yeah, wow. her mom was there. And she has even said publicly she was in DOS, but she wasn't branded. And she wished she had been branded because she wanted to have that homage to her master, Keith. Kind of makes sense to me now because she was obviously groomed for this abuse.
Yeah. You know, talking to you, part of the reason this was so hard for me to come and to speak publicly like this is I do have fear because the stuff that happened was so heinous and so appalling that I do have fear of speaking publicly about these things, that the people who are at the helm of the Osho organizations might for retribution or, you know, I don't know.
Well, it's a way more powerful organization than NXIVM ever was.
Oh, yeah.
It still is. Sarah and I were certainly afraid when they cranked up their litigation machine against us.
But this is also a different era, too. Don't forget, Erin. Like, this is the era when people are speaking their truth and telling their stories.
Yeah.
Any retaliation against you will clearly, it'll be seen for what it is. And yeah. Your light wins, you know? We've always believed that. Truth wins. Love wins.
Yeah.
Hey, culty listeners. Lovers of cult-busting content. ALBCers, culty kids, we've gotten a lot of requests to put up a link where people can throw some funds up behind the podcast and help support what Little Bit Culty is doing. And you know what? That's a great idea. Thank you for that. And as we've gotten to know other podcasters and learn more about this whole podcast thing, we've been learning that it takes a whole lot of different resources and different sources of revenue and listener support to keep it rolling. Sponsorships and ads and the occasional appeal to amazeballs listeners like you. That's why we added a way for anyone who wants to support the show to do exactly that. You can go to alittlebitculty.com/support or the link in our Instagram bio or smash that link in our show notes to make a one-time contribution or a recurring one. We will pay your support forward with a galactic level of love and light and healing resources, of course. Again, it's alittlebitculty.com/support or check out the link in our Instagram bios. Next up, we really got to figure out what to call you, our listenership. ALBC Nation? Flying Monkeys? We're going to have to workshop that. Thanks, guys. Our team at A Little Bit Culty Podcasts loves the Blood Ties podcast because it is gritty and current and fascinating. It's also a little bit culty. Blood Ties, the award-winning audio drama from Wondery, returns for its third season, Strange Days, with another thrilling story about greed, power, and deception. 5 years have passed since Eleanor, played by Julian Jacobs of Community, took over as CEO of the infamous Richland family empire, alongside her half-brother, Santino, played by Christian Navarro of 13 Reasons Why. Together, they decide to invest the family fortune in a groundbreaking, controversial new drug. But as shocking revelations about the new treatment emerge, Eleanor and Santino go to every length to protect their control of the Richland family dynasty. As Eleanor's father always said, medicine is a bloody business. Listen to Blood Ties, Season 3, Strange Days, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or you can binge the whole series now, early and ad-free, by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app. Is there anything else you want to share with us about red flags or things that happened in your vast time there? How many years was it from when you got to Oregon? And did you leave when he died?
From 1977, when I went to India, I stayed in the commune, or once the commune, even after he died, it disbanded and it was just loose. I still considered myself a sannyasin, or that he was still my master, until a year ago, which just, I cannot believe it. It's like, what was I thinking? I knew these horrible things had happened, but I could not put it together that how would this man, this extraordinary master, how could it be that there could be so much darkness and evil around him? And I just figured, I'm never going to know. So I was living my life all these decades thinking, I'll never understand it. I don't get it. I never looked through it to see that maybe he wasn't so great.
Yeah. What was it that woke you up a year ago?
I was having a lot of marriage problems, was in therapy with my wife, and the therapist said something about being brainwashed. Oh, but Aaron, you were brainwashed. And, you know, I said, I've heard that before because I'd heard it for decades. And I had my answer that was the answer that he had given us.
Which was?
Nobody can understand, because unless you've experienced a master of masters, how do people know?
Of course.
Yeah. It's impossible for anyone outside to recognize.
Right.
That was the answer.
Right. And quick tangent here, because I noticed this in Wild Wild Country, and I want to make sure that this is clear for people, because when I was watching, going, if I really believed that this commune was all about love and humanity, and we're a new way for humanity, new way of living, and we're all those things, and then people outside obviously don't understand. They just don't get it because they're not part of it. And of course they're going to call us a cult.
Yeah, that's
because they don't get it. Of course they are, because a cult just says, oh, it's evil, and they're just Christians, and they're uptight, and they got their pitchforks, and they're just scared. So of course they're going to call us a cult. And so it's such an easy defense. You can't even examine how it might be a cult.
Yeah.
Okay.
The only other really important red flag, there's so many. I made a list once. It was 3 pages long.
Wow.
But one other really striking thing was that there was violence in the therapy groups. People were beat up, and people were forced to have sex with people they didn't want to. And there were broken bones. And this was back in India. It stopped later. But in India, it should have been a red flag, you know. But again, I just saw it that unless people are willing to go all the way, 100%, which if they have to get beat up, they'll have to get beat up. But I took on this idea that anything is good that happens in his garden.
Well, that's actually something I wanted to ask you about. There's that footage in Wild Wild Country that's quite, by the way, massive trigger warning for anybody with any history of trauma, really, of what looks like the meditation thing that you described earlier, but everyone's naked.
Yeah, with the German filmmaker.
The German filmmaker. Yeah. And there's like what looks like a, you know, meditation, but maybe also like, I wasn't sure if they're actually having sex or kind of, you know, going through the motions of gyration. Like some people had clothes on, some people didn't. I couldn't quite figure that out. So you're saying there actually was in these group settings sex happening?
Oh, absolutely.
So there was a lot of group sex and violence and physical damage in the name of finding inner peace.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's tough. That's a tough one.
Do you think Wild Wild Country purposely omitted that stuff?
I don't know. You know, I found Wild Country, I was glad that it was made public, the atrocities that were going on and the crimes. I was glad for that, that it brought it to public attention. But it was very, very narrow. It seemed to me, as somebody who had been there from the beginning, or at least from when I came on, that it was primarily the perspective from Sheila and his secretary and his lawyer. And it did not include the broad scope of what the experience was like for most of us there. And they didn't interview very many people at all. They certainly didn't talk about any of this. I don't know why.
I certainly know that in the cult recovery space, well, at least was helpful for us in that it kind of showed the template and reinforced like the same abuses of power in a much bigger scale. Like for sure, Keith stole directly from Osho some of the teachings and some of the beliefs, and also like tried
the process
and the process, and also tried to create like when people say like what was V Week like, Vanguard Week, the closest I can say is like the good parts of what happened in Oregon and in the ashram in terms of like the community and the music and the ecstatic, the high. I mean, towards the later years, it got really lame. But in the beginning, there were some really powerful, profound group experiences. So I totally relate to that. But one quick sidebar is when Nippy and I were watching Wild Wild Country, one of the craziest things that happened is at the end where Bhagwan gets put on a bus. And like, they call it diesel therapy, where they're like basically giving the...
No, this is after they intercepted his plane when it was refueling. And they drove him back to Oregon. They
drove him back to Oregon on a bus. It's called diesel therapy. And then like, they put him in jail. And literally as that was happening, as we were watching it in real time, the same thing was happening to Keith in real time.
Oh my.
It was wild. It was like, wow. It was like, what the fuck? Like this is mirroring our experience. And this guy's being held accountable and he's going to jail. the other perception we've noticed with Wild Wild Country is that people were like, but it's left it ambiguous. And maybe that's a good thing. Yeah. You know, it's like, well, there was good and there was bad. And clearly he did these illegal things. But also in some ways, I appreciated that because I just like with The Vow, I appreciated how it showed the world what was good about it. It just doesn't go like, look at this crazy motherfucker or whatever. Like, because that does a disservice to people like us or survivors. Because it doesn't explain how we got hooked. It doesn't explain right. why we'd be there in the first place.
I was so missing that in Wild Wild Country. They didn't interview enough people and they didn't right. have people who knew about cults.
Yeah.
Well, it just feels to me, and again, I don't know, you know, like you, Aaron, I'm not going to make accusations, but it just seems to me that if you're doing a documentary on this, there would have to be at least some rumblings about this kind of abuse going on. And if it wasn't uncovered, then it needs to be uncovered.
I hope somebody does. I hope some really, really good producer or whoever it is that can get a hold of this and show what really happened.
Well, we know some people.
So. I really hope it does. Because the thing is, that's the weird contradiction. It was as grand as all that, apparently. But at the same time, the children are being raped. At the same time, right. women are being abused sexually by him.
Right.
At the same time, he's making a hit list. I found this out later, that he made a list of people that should be killed, I was told, if they spoke out or left the group. And I was on that list. That Wild Wild Country is so narrow.
It's narrow. And it's also, if the perpetrators of the crime are curating the narrative, exactly. Sheila, the lawyer, exactly. and all that stuff.
That's
certainly a conflict of interest at the very least. They should be more subjects and be more put to the fire than they were because they seem to be promoting it.
It's spot on.
Still promoting it. There's a lot of ashrams around the world that need to know that the seeds and the foundation of their philosophies are informed by this kind of behavior.
And they're rotten.
Really rotten. Now when I look back, it's like I thought he cared more than anybody could have cared about right. each one of us. But I see now he did not care at all.
No.
Well, that's the con.
It's unbelievable, but it's true. The unbelievable is true.
So your therapist makes a comment about you being brainwashed. You've heard that before. And so then how did the dominoes fall after that?
Okay. So that was over. And for a couple of days, it kept kind of going through my head. I couldn't kind of shake it. And I was in so much distress. Our marriage was about to bust up. It went through my mind just once, what if I was brainwashed? What if? And it was like, that's crazy. And it was like, what if he was a con? What if he's a charlatan? What if I was that whole, all those decades? And it was just literally in 1 minute, it was just, oh my God, it can't be. But literally, it was like in one moment, the whole thing fell apart and smashed
wow.
like a tsunami inside of me. I just felt, oh no, because it wasn't just him that was crumbling and it wasn't just my idea of him and who I thought he was. It was me too,
right.
because who I was for all of my life since I've been with him, part of my identity, maybe the main part of my identity has been that I was a close, very close disciple, devotee of his. I just shattered. But in the shattering, I began to see that he was not who I thought he was and that he was not interested in the whole idea of enlightenment is ridiculous. That's what I think right now. I mean, I know that a lot of people get on my case for that, but
you're entitled to your opinion.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You know, I think it's an awful trap.
I agree.
To make it seem that some people can be living in a true state of consciousness and the rest of us are not.
I find the people that claim to be living in a true state of consciousness don't have a conscience, which allows them to put on the front.
Do you think that he did have anything special or was he enlightened in some way? And then he was like, oh, and I can also have my, you know, like had some worldly desires that he had no boundaries around. You know what I mean? Like, was he someone who was enlightened and he was a sexual predator? Or was he a sexual predator and pretended to be enlightened?
Those don't go hand in hand, sir.
No, I know. I'm like, obviously he can't be fully enlightened, but like, did he have, was any of it real? Was what I'm saying? Like, was any of it, or was it totally a con? Like, people have asked us this about Keith, and I'm like, I'm very clear that he was a charlatan from the beginning. He wasn't like a magic man.
It was, oh, you mean
ego.
Like, did it go bad?
Yeah, like,
was he well intentioned, and it just, you know, he got carried away? Maybe yeah, back on his own question, power. Yeah. And
yes, that's what I want to know.
Believed his own publicity, kind of thing.
Yeah.
I tried on that for many, many years. But when this happened to me about a year ago, and I suddenly thought, what if, just what if?
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw what I have continued to see is that no, mm-hmm. no, he was not. And even the stories of him as a child, he was hypnotizing his family all the time, his cousins and everything. As a little boy, he was studying hypnosis and fascinated by it. And they didn't want to go to family gatherings because little Mohan would hypnotize them. It's hard for me to say it still, but I do believe if that's enlightenment, I don't want anything to do with it. Because if enlightened people can kill people or can be involved in other people's deaths and attempted murders and poisonings and sexual abuse and on, that's not any enlightenment that I want anything to do with.
Amen.
Sarah's heard me say this many a time, and she's probably going to roll her eyes when I say it, but I really believe this. I think every system takes on the personality of their leader, whether it be a company, a sports team, or whatever. And if that kind of thing is going on with children in your purview and you're the leader of it, you're in some way inspiring it with whatever you're doing, and there's no room for it. Anything that crosses the line sexually and abuse to me is the worst violation I think you can do to a person, physical. And anything that exists in that, I think, ultimately is an effect of the leader in some shape or form, normally, particularly if he's teaching everyone and lecturing everyone.
And there's the spiritual abuse. I mean, I've often thought about
for
it.
Sure.
Like, the sexual part for me, I just didn't hook into that so much. But to take something like gratitude, which is such a beautiful thing, to live in gratitude mm-hmm. and to live in celebration of what life gives us, that's a beautiful thing. But to mm-hmm. take that and turn it to use the very thing, to use living a life in gratitude to make people complicit, to make people accept everything that goes on and believe that everything is good, even these horrific crimes, it's spiritual abuse. It's spiritual rape. My story is I just had that opening and then I pretty much fell apart. I didn't know what was up or down. I was out of control. I finally had to give the keys to my car to my wife and say, don't get me because I'm going to do something really bad. Mm-hmm. I was really a wreck. Somehow by a miracle, I was just saying, I need help. I need help. I don't know what's happening to me, but I need help. And we have to find somebody who knows something about cults. And I got connected with Yanya Lalish right away.
Oh, we love Yanya.
Her book's the Bible.
I mean, I don't know how many times I can read that book. I've got it underlined in pink, in yellow, and in green.
Yep. The first 60 to 90 pages were just bam, bam, yeah. bam. This hit me.
I narrated her Audible version.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. And reading it again out loud was like hugely also cathartic because I couldn't, I guess I probably didn't even take it all in the first time. I was in such a state of fight or flight.
But so helpful to see that there are people out here in the world that I was taught not to trust.
Right.
Because they wouldn't understand. But there are so many incredibly knowledgeable, skilled people to help.
Isn't it amazing?
It is amazing. It is amazing. Because I've taken several of the classes from Take Back Your Life.
No, the community waiting for us when we left,
We're so grateful for.
It got us right back on track in our lives in a very, what I think if it had been 20, 30 years earlier, it would have taken us way longer. So I'm forever grateful to those people.
So you read her book and you did therapy with her also?
I didn't do therapy with her, but through her, I found a really good therapist who had been working with people. And I started just to read. I turned into a voracious reader. I read I read every book that any sannyasin ever wrote. And then I started calling people who had left early, saying, I want to talk to you, you know, or even people that had been in jail. And I had read that their testimony in the courts, they said that there was psychological abuse. So I called them and I was sort of on this mission to try to find out what people knew and what actually happened. And I started reading also about cults and what makes a cult. And I couldn't believe it. I was shocked because I went into these groups with people and they all said what group they were in. And my jaw dropped and I thought, yeah, you guys were all in cults. I wasn't. you know? And it took me a while.
Are you alone in this? Do you have people that were with you that were in the same? Do you know what I'm asking?
Yeah, like, I do know. And here's the thing. Yes, I have felt very, very alone in it, because the people that were with me at the core, most of them in this inner circles that were not the inner circles around the administration, like Sheila, and that was a different circle, but the people that were really close to him as devotees and living closely near him, they are all pretty much not only still identified as disciples, but they are making their livelihoods teaching and leading groups and workshops and meditation groups and programs and trainings based on the teachings of Osho. So I know that me speaking to you right now, that some of them are going to hear this. And yes, I do feel alone. A few people, after I sent a letter to the Osho community telling them what I had experienced. I tell you, it was the hardest thing I ever did, was to write that letter. And after that, other women started to say pieces of their stories have been coming forward, but barely.
Mm-hmm. It's a hard thing to do.
Yeah. My hope is that more people will, because it is what happened and it has to come out.
What would you say to those people who are still running retreats and workshops, and like, what would you want them to know?
Really good question. Actually, I can't say anything to that. I mean, they'll know what they want to know.
Right.
I just want to speak what happened, because I know that this is what my experience was, and I want to tell it. And I hope that other people will take the courage to tell more their experiences. And then the truth of what happened is going to do what it does in the world.
I think that's true. And I've said this many times on our podcast, like, if they went through this whole thing and were unscathed, which is probably unlikely, or didn't see things, which is again unlikely, but let's just say they had a great experience. Good for them. But at this point, and they'll probably demand evidence or even character assassinate you, which
I'm sure,
of course, happened to us and happens often to survivors of such issues. It's still happening. As an enlightened person or somebody on the path, it behooves them to search for the truth. And that's going to be a bind for them, because if they really do teach what they say that they teach, they need to be compassionate with you and hear your truth and honor your experience and hold space for you. If they don't, then they're charlatans too. So let's see what they do.
Like when I wrote that letter, I got private messages from a couple of them, and they were nasty.
I bet.
They were nasty. How could you? Maitri, how could you?
Right.
How could you?
Yeah, instead of how could he?
Or how could you not? How could you not want to tell what really happened? That's the sick thing about this, that for all these decades, I've been sitting here living like I had duct tape on my mouth. Like I couldn't speak. I was terrified to say what actually had happened with me privately with him, because nobody knew. Yeah, it took this much time. It's crazy.
And how does it feel to have said it?
This is my healing, actually.
Good.
Mm-hmm.
This is my healing. Good. Because I couldn't speak, and I couldn't say what was true, and I couldn't speak spontaneously and easily with anybody. I was like locked. I felt like I was gagged and locked. So speaking to you and knowing that others will hear it, this is a huge part of my healing for myself, reclaiming myself.
So honored to be part of that with you, Aaron. Truly.
You know, we were talking last night about, it's incredibly brave what you're doing, and thank you for trusting us with your story to impart it into some wisdom.
It is hard to break these spells, I can say, because I was living in this spell for so many years. It's still hard for me to break it every day. Every freaking day, I wonder, how did this happen? This is my life. I'm getting close to 70. I look back at my life. I didn't have my family. I didn't do my career. I gave my entire life to him. How could this be? Yet it is. This is what happened. I hope the truth comes out more and more. That's all. I know that there's a lot more from a lot of other people that hasn't been spoken about, because it's so frightening and it breaks the spell, but it's a great spell to break.
How has this awakening for you affected your life now? Like, where are you at in your healing, and how has it affected your art? I'm curious.
Honestly, I haven't been able to paint since I had this realization or recognition. Mm-hmm. Just trying to pick up the pieces of who I am, and I've been dealing with a lot of PTSD and other trauma stuff, so I haven't painted, and I look forward to painting again soon. I do.
There's a podcast I want to recommend to you and to our listeners. who may be in the same boat or similar boats. It's called Lessons on Leaving by Jennifer Chiaba. She's one of our collaborators in the hashtag I Got Out movement, which you also may want to consider checking out for support, that Yanya is also involved with, Yanya Lalich. Right. And her podcast episode is called Healing Through Art. And there's two parts. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And I listened to that to prep for a talk I did about healing and creativity. Maybe we can continue to talk offline about that.
Yeah.
As artists. And in terms of PTSD, some things I'd share is, you know, really taking the time for your own self-care, which is hard when, and especially just as a reminder, you may get an onslaught of people wanting to interview you or talk more after this, or at least for me, there was a real rush of adrenaline in telling my story and making sure that people knew the truth. And then I didn't take care of myself. And so you kind of have to find this balance of like unwinding and then like really insulating yourself.
And saying no.
And saying no. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was a poem I wrote in my book about my scar. There's a line that goes through my head, which is I wrap myself in cashmere sheets and I plant barbed wire between us so I can heal. And I see you're wearing, I think, what looks like a cashmere sweater.
I am.
And I love cashmere too. So it's like this feeling of like you have to just like take hot. I take a hot bath with Epsom salts every night.
Every night.
You know, every night. But I don't
sometimes
get my bath.
Two.
You
too. Sometimes two. On occasionally three. Like in this last year, I have had days where I take three baths, always with Epsom salts and essential
Amazing.
Oils.
Oh, yes. I was going to say essential oils. I'm going to send you a present, a CBD love bomb. I'm going to send that love bomb. Uh-huh. Oh my God, talk about Freudian. A CBD bath bomb. I'm going to love bomb you with bath bombs. I'll send it with my book and some a little bit culty merchandise if you'll wear it.
Yeah. The whole thing of taking care, that's what we never did when we were in the group. I mean, never.
No.
Right.
It was selfish. It was indulgent. But I can't tell you how many days I haven't gotten out of my pajamas. And I need time to cry every day. I mean,
just
buckets of tears, you know? But at the same time, I think I'm getting through. I think I'm kind of coming to a place. And I think actually speaking with you and letting other people know what actually happened, it's probably the most profound healing that I could have.
Absolutely.
There's light at the other end of the tunnel. I absolutely promise you. And you'll look back at this time and go, wow, I've got through some shit. And it's totally okay. You can stay in pajamas as long as you want. Hey, there's no need to rush
in that
it.
World.
Yeah. I know, isn't it true? And it's amazing to see how just the question, what if, you know, if anybody ever has any doubt, like maybe you were, just what if? Because that was my door.
That is a profound door, and I'm so glad you opened it and came through on the other side, because it's a gift, and I truly hope that this story and this truth reaches the right people so that, you know, the abuse stops and the truth comes out about who he was and what he did to you and others, many others, I'm sure.
And the children, the children who are now in their 50s, but who were children around him, not voluntarily.
Right.
So hope for them that they can get the healing they need, because there are many of them, dozens and dozens, hundreds actually, that are really suffering.
Yeah. Well, Erin, again, thank you so much for your candidness and your vulnerability and your strength. And if I can be an ally for you in this part of your healing journey, please don't ever hesitate to reach out, because it's a tough road, you know, it's a tough road, but you're not alone in it at all.
It's a good road to be on. Thank you both so much.
Welcome to freedom.
Thank you, Erin.
Imagine yourself walking into a forest. You can see the path and the trees. High above you, the air is crisp. You are walking towards your happy place. Allegedly, say it with me. Anything said here on this podcast about alleged cults, alleged MLM schemes, alleged douchebaggery, mindfuckery, criminality, spiritual fraud, or the like, is offered purely as commentary, because the views and opinions expressed on A Little Bit Culty do not necessarily reflect on official policy or position of the podcast. And any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business individual, anyone, or anything. So just let these words drift into your mind without needing to focus on any of them. You are great. You are capable. You deserve to be happy. Nobody's mad at you, unless you're actually a narcissistic, culty criminal. If that's you, cut that shit out. Don't be a fuckwad. But if that's not you, again, you are great. You are capable. You deserve to be happy. A little bit culty loves you. Well, that was, again, intense.
I feel like there's more there.
Yeah. Actually, since recording this, as we've mentioned, we get a lot of emails from different people wanting to know more about different things, including Wild Wild Country since we started. But we've also been in contact with a number of survivors, which I believe are some of the children that Aaron mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
These women and men are now in their 40s and 50s, and they're coming to terms with what happened to them. Side note, since recording this, we got clarification from Aaron that the young woman she mentioned was actually raped, let's just call it what it is, by over 100 adults between the ages of 12 and 15. It's still obviously horrendous. We just want to be accurate with our words. And truth time, in the interview itself, I was so shocked when Aaron shared that she was sterilized. I didn't know that prior, and I didn't ask any follow-up questions. I'm still processing what that all means. So yeah, more to discuss in future episodes. And we definitely want to do another episode with some of the children survivors if and when they are ready.
I gotta say, I don't know how you get in the orbit of this story for a Netflix documentary or whatever and not know this, and how this thing has, what was it, 3,600 Osho centers around the world? How does this...
Yeah, this stuff is still going. It also makes me equally mad at Netflix in the wake of the Bad Vegan Sarma debacle. And I don't know if that's Netflix
or
the director or the producer or who did what. All I know is that they didn't do right by her. And they didn't protect her, someone who is clearly in trauma, and expose the truth. And this is the same thing I feel about Wild Wild Country. I enjoyed the documentary when I saw it. I found it helpful and I found it balanced, showing what was good about it, which I always do think is important because it shows what draws people in. But they didn't really show what was fully bad about it. They showed part of it, but to ignore all the sexual abuse. And I've since found out from a dear friend who had many friends involved at the time that apparently before even going, and I don't think Aaron mentioned this, before going to the ranch, you had to get tested for STDs. So there was the understanding that sort of free love and sex was going to be part of this, but not for the children. If as a community of adults and sexual exploration is a part of what you're signing up for, great, good for you. Not my jam, but children can't consent. It's just really messed up.
That's the part that traps my ass.
So how does Netflix not know this?
Well, I don't know. That's the thing. It's hard to figure out who knows what and what's going on.
Yeah. Either way, we are so appreciative of Aaron for trusting us. And also, little sidebar, I have managed to find my long-lost friend, Tui, and we've connected over Facebook. I just typed in Tui, and I found her. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
And on a positive note.
Kind of seems a little silly to do a word salad, but we do have one.
We have a word salad.
It's an Osho original. I don't think existence wants you to be serious. I have not seen a serious tree. I have not seen a serious bird. I have not seen a serious sunrise. I have not seen a serious starry night. It seems they are all laughing in their own ways, dancing in their own ways. We may not understand it, but there is a subtle feeling that the whole existence is a celebration.
Is that word salad?
It says nothing. Well, then the nature of word salad is that you're going to connect the dots, but I don't have to really say anything that's that profound. You're going to make it profound because you think I'm profound.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that profound. I just think that's a particularly, it may not seem that roundabout confusing, but it's more like, it's just a cover up for what he's actually doing. And that also chaps my ass, Guys, season 4, we love doing this. We love you, the audience. Aaron, friends for life, looking forward to meeting you one day in person. Nippy, you're pretty awesome too.
Thanks, babe.
See you next time.
See ya. Sinking down to the depths of the ocean. I'm hanging on to the weight of my love. If I let go of it all, I could leave. But I know. Let's keep the conversation going.
We'll be back soon with more episodes of A Little Bit Culty with more experts and survivors. And sometimes experts who are survivors, as well as some familiar faces from The Vow from HBO. If you've got suggestions or questions on upcoming topics, find us on Instagram at A Little Bit Culty.
And for more background on what brought me here, my memoir, Scarred, the True Story of How I Escaped NXIVM, the Cult That Bound My Life, is available on Amazon, Audible, and where most books are sold.
If you'd like to help us spread the word about A Little Bit Culty podcast, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe.
Seriously, like, take out their phone and tell them to press subscribe. It takes a second. We're also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app. And if you're listening on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art of this podcast to find show notes and helpful resources.
You might also find some offers from our sponsors there. And when you support our sponsors, you help us keep this podcast going. Just don't be a little bit culty about it.
A Little Bit Culty is executive produced by me, your co-host, Sarah Edmondson, and Anthony Nippy Ames.
That's me.
Associate producer is Jess Tardy. Produced, edited, mixed, and mastered by Citizens of Sound. Our amazing theme song, Cultivated, is by John Bryant and co-written by Nigel Asselin. I'm Sarah Edmondson, and thanks for listening to A Little Bit Culty.